introduced by the Young Framework talk. And in this framework, we can write down a quantum analog of the classical Einstein equations, which we call quantum Einstein equations. And I want to introduce these equations, how they look like, and discuss them in loop quantum gravity, and then introduce a kind of slight reformulation of these quantum Einstein equations in terms of an algebraic framework, and I will call this algebraic quantum gravity. And in the second part, I want to speak about a slightly different approach to quantization, which I call reduced phase-based quantization. I want to explain its conceptual setup, which includes the relational framework, the von Puckasch mechanism, and the notion of physical Hamiltonian. And I will explain in detail what these words mean. And with these ingredients, one can then develop a manifestly gauge-invariant framework for general relativity. And finally, I would like to discuss why this might be also useful to look at if the quantization of gravity is considered. And at the end, I will give a conclusion and an outlook. So as we heard in the talk before, the starting point of loop quantum gravity is the canonical formulation of general relativity. And we do not work in these ADM metric variables, but we try to formulate our theory in terms of little slide variables. So the basic elementary phase-based variables we have are holonomies, which are integrated connections along one-dimensional objects, which we call edges. And the conjugate momenta are the so-called electric fields, which we integrate over two surfaces, which then become fluxes. And additionally to these phase-based variables, we get in GR so-called constraints. And the Bianca said already this is the Hamiltonian and the diffeomorphism constraint. And since we use this formulation in terms of holonomies and fluxes, we get an additional SU2 Gauss constraint.
But are those variables strictly equivalent to the original ADM ones, or are these some new variables?
So you can say if you do a symplectic reduction with respect to this new constraint, you end up with the same phase-based description.
And what about things that are degenerate?
No,
in GR, the configuration space of positive definite three metrics.
Yeah, I mean
no room there to include degenerate ones.
No, I mean you assume classical also in GR that the determinant of Q is bigger than zero.
Yes.
So that's also fine.
Do you include degeneracies in your phase space?
No. I mean it's the same phase space, the same ADM phase space I start with. If I use this polynomial and flux description. So does this answer your question?
I'm not sure.
I mean, you can prove this. And what we do then is we use the standard Dirac quantization, which was introduced by Bianca already. So what we would like to do is we do not want to solve this constraint on the classical side, but we want to solve them at the quantum level. So what one does in Dirac quantization is one introduces a kinematical Hilbert space, which I call H-kin. And the requirement for the representation of this kinematical Hilbert space is that we can implement these classical constraints as constraint operators. So we allow only those representations which support our classical constraints as operators. And the quantum analog of these constraints equation are then the so-called quantum Einstein equations. But let me say a few words about this Hilbert space. So as Bianca said already, an informal basis of the Hilbert space are so-called spin network functions that we work with. And we can think of such a spin network function as a union as defined on a graph. And a graph is just a union of these single edges which meet in vertices, which are indicated by these black points here. And to each of these edges, we associate an SU2 spin quantum number. And such a spin network function is then supposed to carry some information about the geometry. And in this space, we can then write down the quantum Einstein equations, which basically state that we are only interested in those states which are annihilated by all the constraint operators. Only those states will have physical relevance. So one can formulate mathematically rigorously these quantum Einstein equations. So what we would like to do, as we usually do in physics, solve these equations
apply it to physical interesting situations, and then make predictions and either falsify or verify our model. However, we can write down solutions to the Gauss constraint. This is quite easy. It's a bit more complicated to find general solutions to the diffeomorphism constraint. And as was already pointed out by Bianca, the main problem is the Hamiltonian constraint. So these equations are very complicated. They have even a non-polynomial structure in the configuration variables. And it's very hard. We cannot just write down the general set of solutions, which is not too surprising, because also in classical GR, we cannot just sit down and write down the general analytical solution of the Einstein equation. However, if we work with special solutions, what you do in classical GR, it's a bit more complicated for the quantum case, because you could get formal solutions, as was said by Bianca, for instance, the Kodama state. But as long as we do not know how the physical Hilbert space looks like, where these states would live in, we do not know whether they have not finite or zero norm in this Hilbert space. And then this would mean such states would have no physical relevance. So a first step maybe is to be, instead of looking for maybe the hopeless question to find the general set of solution, is what about the semi-classical properties of these equations? What do we know about the semi-classical properties? And is there a way to find general relativity, to rediscover general relativity in that framework? And so what we would like to do is we would like to define so-called kinematical coherent states, which are labeled by a certain phase space point A and E. And one of the properties these states should have is that if I calculate expectation values of my basic operators, which are the holonomy and the flux operator, with respect to these kinematical coherent states, I should just obtain the classical value plus tiny quantum correction. So these states approximate my basic operators well. And one could think of these states, one can indeed construct such states on the kinematical Hilbert space, and they look like Gaussian states which are peaked around a given classical phase space point. And Bianca said what we are looking for are basically physical coherent states which are preserved under the dynamics, and I would agree, but these states are not, they are just kinematical in a sense. But as long as I would like to test the quantum Einstein equations, I need kinematical states, because I want to test constraint operators which would vanish on the physical Hilbert space. So I have to do this test on the kinematical Hilbert space. And also, this was already mentioned a bit by Bianca. What about the lower energy limit of loop quantum gravity in the symmetry reduced model, which we call loop quantum cosmology, where you specialize your holonomy and fluxes to the symmetries of, for instance, an FRW spacetime, and you quantize then the framework. The quantum Einstein equation simplifies a lot. And one can, in this framework, indeed define physical coherent states and analyze the quantum dynamics that comes out of this framework. And one of the results also mentioned by Bianca was the resolution of singularities. In the other approach we heard before, in spin forms, also there one has analyzed the semi-classical propagator, and it turns out that it has the correct asymptotic decay behavior. So what about full loop quantum gravity? And again, if we want to analyze full loop quantum gravity semi-classical, it's the Hamiltonian constraint operator which makes trouble. So far, nobody has succeeded in defining coherent states which would approximate the Hamiltonian operator in a good way, which means that I basically get the classical Hamiltonian constraint up to tiny quantum corrections. So one way is to work harder on these physical coherent states or different kinematical coherent states, which would be able to deal with such a complicated operator, and there is work in progress by people in the field. A second idea, how Wood can nevertheless maybe get some semi-classical information out of loop quantum gravity, is to ask, is there a way to reformulate the quantum Einstein equation such that I can analyze them semi-classical? And indeed, there seems to be a way, and the idea is to change two basic ingredients of loop quantum gravity and to reformulate in a kind of algebraic version, and this I will call algebraic quantum gravity. And one of the basic ingredients that is changed in algebraic quantum gravity is the classical starting point. So it was already mentioned in the talk before, there's a master constraint program. So what the master constraint program does is, so instead of working with a single Gauss, diffeomorphism, and Hamiltonian constraints, one defines the so-called master constraint, which includes the squares of the single constraint weighted by a certain function and integrated over all three space-time dimensions. And this weighting is chosen such that the total expression for the classical master constraint is spatially diffeomorphism invariant. And classically, one can show that the master constraint and the three separated Hamiltonian Gauss and diffeomorphism constraint define the same constraint surface. And of course, this does not necessarily have to be true if we go towards the quantization of such a classical master constraint. But there has been lots of work by Bianca Dittrich and Thomas Thiemann where they tested the master constraint program. And in all these examples, which were much easier than GR, one has a kind of positive result in the sense that you obtain the correct solution, which you also would expect by working with the three separated constraints. And
so I think it's Feynman who said you can always have just a single physical. You can always boil all of your knowledge of physics down into a single equation by just setting all the laws equal to zero, squaring them, summing it up, and then your law of physics is minimize that function, right? So, but obviously you don't want, you know, that's obviously silly. Because it's very complex. So how is this master constraint simpler than just solving the three separate constraints?
Okay, that's exactly my next point. Okay. So the actual solution of the quantum Einstein equations, as I will show later, would then just be m psi equal to zero. And this solution is, of course, also very complicated. But one advantage you have when you use the master constraint is you have a lot more freedom in the quantization without running automatically into anomalies, which you would get for the Hamiltonian. And so this is a bit technical, but I try to make a picture of it. As Bianca said, when we quantize the Hamiltonian, it has to be in a very ultra-local way. So the Hamiltonian action is basically just that it attaches a loop very local to a vertex that it is acting on. And I can quantize the master constraint in this way, but I have a certain freedom due to the constraint algebra, which is trivial because I'm having only one constraint. I could also quantize it in a way that it attaches a loop, which is not as local as before. And in particular, this loop only goes along already existing edges of the graph. So in this sense, it's very close to the quantization you use in lattice gauge theory.
And question, couldn't you have already tried it with the Hamiltonian constraint?
If you do this, then
instead
you...
Instead of the master constraint.
No, then you cannot fulfill the algebra of two Hamiltonian constraints. Then you have automatically an anomaly.
That's similar. You mentioned Kibbashin-Brown at the start of the talk. That has a similar composite constraint, which has better properties.
Yeah, I will talk about this later on. I will use the Kukash. But this is still the constraint Hamiltonian and not the physical Hamiltonian. So there's some technical arguments behind, but the main difference is that I can choose either one or the other quantization for the master constraint. And I want to use this freedom to quantize it not in this way, but in the non-ultra local. And the second ingredient I would like to change is we heard in loop quantum gravity. We work with graphs which are embedded in a spatial manifold, and we have to consider all graphs which can be embedded in this manifold. And since I can quantize this operator now in a way that it attaches only loops to my graph which do not change the graph, I would like to base my theory not on finite graphs which are embedded in a manifold, but I would like to base my theory on one fundamental infinite algebraic graph. And an algebraic graph is basically just defined by a number of points, which would correspond to the vertices in loop quantum gravity. and the information how many arrows point from one point to the other, which would correspond to the edges in loop quantum gravity. But I do not know how these edges are threaded, which is an information I have if I speak about embedded graphs. And the difference to the graphs in loop quantum gravity is that the information about the topology and the differential structure of the spatial manifold where the graphs are embedded is absent on these algebraic levels. Nevertheless, the idea is to define an abstract algebraic operator which acts on these algebraic graphs. And one can indeed do this. So instead of working with these embedded holonomy and flux algebra, we define an analogous abstract algebra on this combinatorial level. And then we use Dirac quantization as for loop quantum gravity. So we would like to define a kinematical Hilbert space. And this is also possible in this framework. We do not end up with the same Hilbert space which we have in loop quantum gravity. We end up with von Neumann's infinite tensor product Hilbert space. But all spatial diffeomorphism invariant operators which we have in loop quantum gravity, which are independent of the embedding, can be easily lifted to this algebraic level. And the dynamics, which is usually described by the quantum Einstein equations, would in this framework then just be described by a non-ultra-local acting master constraint operator. So the quantum Einstein equations in this framework would just be m psi equal to zero. So we have a kind of reformulation of the quantum Einstein equations, which I agree might not be maybe not much easier to solve, but still, the whole motivation for reformulating these Einstein equations was to test them semi-classically. And what one needs in order to define semi-classical techniques is the following data. One needs to have a three-manifold sigma and the classical phase space point A of E. And I need to provide an embedding of this abstract graph into this manifold sigma. And then I can construct along the lines we construct usually in loop quantum gravity analogous algebraic coherent states. So the idea of that framework is that the topology and the differential structure of sigma and the metric we want to approximate it is not is absent on this algebraic level, but is encoded in semi-classical coherent states. So the picture you could have in mind is, suppose we have an infinite algebraic graph up here, and certain edges of this infinite graph are excited, then the master constraint would act on these infinite lattice by changing certain labels of these lattice, and this would describe the quantum dynamics. But whenever we go to the semi-classical sector of the theory, we know how such an algebraic graph is embedded into a given manifold. And it turns out if one constructs these coherent states and then calculates the expectation value of this algebraic master constraint operator with respect to this coherent state, one can indeed show that the zeros order reproduces the classical master constraint. So in terms of if infinitesimal symmetry generators are concerned, we have a positive result in this algebraic framework such that the infinitesimal generators of GR seems to be discovered in that framework. However, as was already asked, in a sense, this framework is a bit more simple if you, for instance, would like to do numerical calculation because you work on a fixed infinite lattice compared to loop quantum gravity. So it's technically simpler in the sense that it's closer formulated to ordinary lattice gauge theory. However, the quantum Einstein equations, including the squares of the Hamiltonian, are still very complicated. So it's still hard to obtain general control about the physical Hilbert space in this framework. So it might be sensible to look for different or parallel ideas how one can extract physical information out of algebraic quantum gravity or loop quantum gravity. And one of the ideas is to speak about or to work with observables. And this was also, Bianca mentioned in her talk already the problem of time. And what is the problem of time in general relativity? So we know in any physical theory, observables are by definition gauge invariant quantities. And if we consider GR as a gauge theory, the gauge group would be the group of space-time diffeomorphisms. And if I go to the canonical picture,
in the metric variables, then I just have the Gauss and the Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraints, and I can show that they generate spatial time and gauge transformations. So the Hamiltonian is basically generating gauge transformations from one hyperslice to the other, and the diffeomorphism is generating spatial diffeomorphisms within such a three-dimensional hypersurface. So the condition that a quantity is gauge invariant means that it has to commute, Poisson commute, with these generators. And when we write down the canonical Hamiltonian of general relativity, from which the Einstein equations can be derived in the canonical framework, one can show that it's just a linear combination of constraints. So it's basically given by the integral over these constraints, weighted by a certain lapse function for the Hamiltonian and a certain shift vector for the diffeomorphism constraint. So in this sense, since it's just a linear combination of constraints, the canonical Hamiltonian itself is constrained to vanish. So from this we have, if O is a gauge invariant quantity, it necessarily has to Poisson commute with the canonical Hamiltonian. But this is exactly the way how you usually calculate evolution of quantities. So in this sense, whenever we speak about observables, we have no evolution. We have frozen picture, which of course contradicts experiments because we measure something. And this is known as the problem of time and general relativity. And one way to circumvent the problem of time was introduced by Rovelli and goes back to some work in the 50s by Bergmann and others. And they took seriously the fact or the comment that, strictly speaking, the Einstein equations should not be interpreted as physical evolution equations, but rather as evolution equations for unphysical quantities under gauge transformations, exactly for the reasons I explained on the slide before. So, but we do measure something, and so we need a kind of strategy how we nevertheless can introduce something like space and time in general relativity. And one idea is the so-called relational formalism. So suppose we have two quantities, f and g, which are just certain phase-space functions. And I choose one of these phase-space functions, in this case g, to become the clock of my system. And the idea is then to define a gauge invariant extension of lowercase f with respect to the clock t I choose in relation to the clock the value t takes. So the picture we have in mind is that we have two gauge non-invariant quantities which move along the gauge orbit. And any point on this gauge orbit, I would need to physically identify with each other because they are just related by gauge transformation. So moving along here is not really a physical movement, and moving along here is also not really physical evolution. But what can be formulated in a gauge invariant manner is the movement of f with respect to the values that g takes. So we want to define such a gauge invariant extension of f as a function of tau, where tau are exactly certain numbers that my function g takes if it moves along the gauge orbit, like 5, 17, 45, whatever you like. And 2005, Bianca Dittrich was working on this subject, and she found a way how such a gauge invariant extension for a general phase space function f can be written down for a system for generally constrained systems. So you have a set of constraints, and the formula Bianca developed just tells you, okay, you need as many clocks as you have constraints, and then you can write down such a gauge invariant extension of f as a power series in these clock variables, where the coefficients include multiple Poisson brackets of the constraints and f. And of course, for a general constraint system, and in particular for general relativity, this formula looks quite complicated. But although it's quite complicated, one has a clear conceptual strategy how to construct weak observables. So in general, these guys which I construct with these Bianca's formula do only weakly commute with the constraints, which means only on the constraint surface.
Sorry?
Does that provide enough pieces of strategy for constructing them? One of the problems with this sort of field is that they've always complained that you may not be able to find enough to describe nature.
Of course, I mean, you have to check that you can, that you have enough observables to coordinate your phase space in a situation where you apply it, yes. But
has that been checked in the strategy?
Yes,
that
yes. And especially there have been lots of examples already done by Bianca where this formula has been checked. And recently it was also applied to cosmology and in particular to cosmological perturbations where gauge invariance becomes an important issue. So what I would like now to do is to introduce a clock and a ruler for general relativity in order to give space and time a physical meaning. And we have, for each space point, we have one Hamiltonian and three components of the diffeomorphism constraint. So we would need one times infinity clocks for time and three times infinity rulers for space. So the most easy thing we could possibly choose are four scalar fields, which would be four times infinitely many clocks. And additionally, I do not want to choose just for scalar fields, but I want to choose certain scalar fields in a sense that I would like to choose the optimal clock for cosmology. And in cosmology, what I usually assume is a free-falling observer. So I would like to choose clocks which mimic the free-falling observer, which I usually assume in cosmology. And it turns out that such a clock is already around in the literature. So Brown and Kukash introduced the so-called dust Lagrangian, which includes the four metric here. Rho is basically the energy density of this metal, and U mu is the four velocity, which can be expressed in terms of these scalar fields T, W, J, and S, J, where J runs from 1 to 3. And the basic variables I work with in this framework are rho, T, W, J, and S, J. And if one then looks at the Euler-Lagrange equation for these four variables, one obtains, for instance, from the Euler-Lagrange equation for rho, that these four velocity is normalized to -1. One can then use these Euler-Lagrange equations further on in order to extract the following physical interpretation. So these U mu fields are basically geodesic. And it turns out that the fields WJ and SJ are constant along each geodesic, and T defines proper time along each geodesic. So if I consider then the energy momentum tensor of this material, it turns out that it looks like the one of a pressureless perfect fluid, and that's why they call it dust. And a technical remark, so I would like to have a free-falling observer which moves forward in time, in my dust time, and in order to reach a positive Hamiltonian and this requirement that I have that my time flow is positive, I need to assume that the energy density of this material is negative. And so this WJ field is basically fixed by the canonical momenta, if I go to the canonical analysis of these Lagrangian. So what I would like to choose as time are the T fields, and what I would like to choose as rulers are the SJ fields. And I will call the values that my time clock takes tau, and the values that my ruler basically takes sigma of J. So the phantom dust serves basically as a physical reference system for general relativity. And if I then go to the canonical picture, I introduce the canonical momenta P and PJ with respect to T and SJ. And just to have a short end, I will call all the remaining physical degrees of freedom, which are gravity and the scalar field, just by PA and QA. And then one does a detailed constraint analysis of the system gravity plus a scalar field plus these dust fields. And one ends up with the following first class constraint. So one has the Hamiltonian constraint, which contains the contribution of geometry and matter, the scalar field matter, and a dust contribution, which has the following form. And the same for the diffeomorphism constraint, the matter and geometry plus the dust contribution, whereby the dust contribution looks like this.
And the idea of Brown and Kukas was then to say, okay, if I look at the Hamiltonian contribution of the dust, I see that the configuration variables just enter in a certain combination, which is equivalent to the diffeomorphism constraint of the dust. So by using that the total diffeomorphism constraint is constrained to vanish, I can replace the CA dust here by minus CA. And this has the consequence that I can solve the Hamiltonian constraint equation for P, and also the diffeomorphism constraint equation for PJ. And in order to solve the second equation for PJ, I have to assume that I can invert these SJ, A's. So it's an assumption which enters the framework. And by solving these constraints, then for P and PJ, one can write down an equivalent set of constraints, which are linear in the dust momentum, so P plus H, where H has this following form here, and the same for PJ, where HJ has this following form here. And one speaks then about a partial deparameterization of general relativity. So a constraint is called deparameterized if I manage to write it at P plus H, where H does not depend on the dust variables anymore, which is the case for the Hamiltonian. Yeah, these are just geometry and matter contributions. But for the diffeomorphism constraint, I see there are still some dust fields around, so I haven't deparameterized the diffeomorphism constraint. Nevertheless, these two constraints mutually commute, which is also not true for the usual Hamiltonian and diffeomorphism constraint. So I have rewritten them in a way that things become more simple. And in particular, if I apply now the formula Bianca developed, also in this case, it simplifies. And moreover, we do not have weak observables in this case due to the fact that these constraints commute strongly, we become strong observables. And one of the advantages that these two constraints commute is that if I would now like to construct observables which are invariant under these two constraints, I can do this in two steps. So let's, for instance, assume I start with my ADM3 metric, which is in general a function of x and t. So in the first reduction, I produce spatially diffeomorphism invariant quantities, which I call q tilde I of g. And these are not functions of x anymore, but these become now functions of sigma, of the values that my ruler takes. And in the second reduction, I construct quantities which are also invariant with respect to the Hamiltonian constraint, and I will call such manifestly gauge invariant quantities by capital letters. So in the case of the three metric, this would just be qig of sigma and tau, where tau are again the values which my clock, my time clock takes. So with the formula for the gauge invariant extension and this way of rewriting the constraints introduced by Brown and Kukas, we have in principle a strategy to construct gauge invariant extensions for all matter and gravity degrees of freedom. And one can show that this formula is an automorphism. So if we manage to construct these gauge invariant extensions for our elementary phase space variables, then we can easily write down any gauge invariant extension of functions of these variables, which just become functions of the gauge invariant versions of my Q and my P. However, it's nice to have observables on the way to construct them, but additionally, I would like to see how these observables evolve. So I would like to introduce something which is called physical Hamiltonian, because it generates the evolution of observables. So we saw before, if we take the canonical Hamiltonian of general relativity, and I would Poisson commute it with an observable, it just vanishes. So I have to think about how to introduce such a physical Hamiltonian where the Poisson bracket of an observable and this Hamiltonian really describes physical evolution with respect to dust time. And since I also would like to have this physical Hamiltonian itself be gauge invariant. And it turns out that there's a natural way to derive such a physical Hamiltonian from the deparameterized version of the constraints. So let me recall, we could rewrite the Hamiltonian constraint as p plus h, and h was just a function of the matter and geometry degrees of freedom having the following square root form. So if I would now like to write down the gauge invariant extension of h, it's very simple. I just have to plug in here the gauge invariant extensions of q and p, and I will call the gauge invariant version of c and ca and cb capital C and capital CI and capital CJ. And if I now integrate over all values of sigma, then it turns out that the integral over all values of sigma of this Hamiltonian density indeed generates the physical time evolution of my observables. So this is an evolution with respect to dust time. And moreover, it turns out that this Hamiltonian density does not depend on dust time. So in a sense, I have a conservative Hamiltonian. I describe a time-independent, a system with a time-independent Hamiltonian. And additionally, this physical Hamiltonian has some classical symmetries. And one is that it commutes with CJ. And CJ would be the generators of diffeomorphism in the space of all sigma values, and it also commutes with the Hamiltonian density. So let me summarize. Usually, if I work in the unreduced framework of general relativity, I have these metric variables for gravity, and I can introduce other metal degrees of freedom. I have a canonical Hamiltonian, which can be just written as a linear combination of constraints. And if I just consider the system geometry and math, So I have a Hamiltonian, which can be just written in terms of constraints, which I can use to derive a second order time derivative equation, for instance, for my metric, which looks in general backgrounds like this. And this n is basically just the lattice function, and the n vectors, which are around here, are the shift vectors. And the constraints are just the geometry and matter part, which are constrained to vanish in the Hamiltonian and in the diffeomorphism invariant case. So if I go now to the reduced framework, I have manifestly gauge invariant equation of motion for my capital Q and my capital P, and any matter degree of freedom alike. And if I have a physical Hamiltonian, which has this square root form here, and if I calculate now the evolution equations for Q in this case, it turns out that it's very similar. So we see if I would replace capital letters by lowercase letters, I would nearly match this equation apart from one correction term which occurs here, where this capital G is basically the Wheeler-Dimit form metric. But nevertheless, it seems to be a good clock for cosmology because not much changes.
Sorry?
What is the significance of that term that was in red?
So it's basically the deviation you have if you write your evolution with respect to gauge parameter time or with respect to dust time.
No, I understand that. I understand where it comes from. What I want to know is what it means.
What
What's
it means?
The significance of it?
So cosmological, it means nothing because we see that it's proportional to the shift vector here. And one can show that in this framework, you get a kind of dynamical lattice and a dynamical shift function. So we see that basically the shift vector is proportional to the diffeomorphism constraint, which would vanish in cosmology.
Okay.
So for FRW cosmology, it would just vanish, and it would really match the equations. Yeah, and just to mention that these constraint equations are no constraint equations anymore in this framework because we have introduced the dust. So only the total constraint would vanish. And what we get is a kind of energy and momentum conservation instead. So we see it seems to be quite a good clock for cosmology because in the background equation, nothing changed. This additional term I would interpret as the influence of the clock because we did not assume
free-falling observer which do not interact with our system, we dynamically couple the observer to the system. But the advantage is that the constraints have completely disappeared from the picture. And we wanted to apply this to a physical interesting situation, and where gauge invariance is an important issue, and this is exactly cosmological perturbation theory. And especially the notion of gauge invariance becomes quite complicated if you go beyond linear order. But so far we have just perturbed these gauge invariant quantities up to linear order in order to check whether we agree with the standard results you obtain if you do the same without introducing the dust. And it turns out that the corresponding FRW equation formally agrees in the sense replacing capital letters by lowercase letters. And for the perturbation, we get additional degrees of freedom because we start with 4 more degrees of freedom, but one can show that these additional degrees of freedom decay. So far this was all classically, and it's maybe a way to introduce the notion of gauge invariance seriously within general relativity. But it's also a big advantage if quantization is concerned, because we do not have to quantize the constraints in this framework. They have been reduced classically, and everything which encodes the physical significant information is the algebra of the observables. So by quantizing the algebra of the observables, we have a direct access to the physical Hilbert space. And so the idea was, okay, let's take loop quantum gravity and quantize the algebra of observables. And for these dust clock, it turns out that the algebra is very simple. It's basically isomorphic to the algebra of the non-observables. And we know how to quantize this. And it seems somehow we have trivialized everything, because such a simple algebra can even be quantized within a Fock representation. However, apart from the algebra, we have this physical Hamiltonian which generates the evolution of the observables. And of course, we would like to have such an operator also in our quantum theory. And this operator is the square root, and it includes certain part of the constraints which are not possible to quantize in standard Fock quantization, but we can use the loop quantum gravity representation of the kinematical Hilbert space. But here we have direct access to the physical Hilbert space. So one effect in this representation is that we get a physical volume which is discrete. So usually this result is obtained on the kinematical level, and there's a question whether it will survive in the physical Hilbert space. But if you choose this representation, then you're sure that you would also get a volume operator with discrete spectrum. The minus part of this representation is that we know that the kinematical representation of loop quantum gravity is non-separable, so we would obtain a non-separable physical Hilbert space here. And a second approach is to quantize this in these algebraic frameworks. And one of the advantages is that you have these infinite algebraic graphs, but the subgraphs are not preserved under the action of this physical Hamiltonian. And so you do not get additionally infinitely many conservation laws, which you would get if you use such a quantization in loop quantum gravity. So the picture that subgraphs are not changing could be understood like this. So suppose I have my infinite lattice, and I would just excite certain regions of the lattice. And while the physical Hamiltonian is acting, it attaches loops to it, and more loops and more loops. And after a certain evolution, these delocalized parts of the lattice would become connected. So one can perform a quantization of the physical Hamiltonian within algebraic quantum gravity, and then one would really have an analog of the Hamiltonian lattice gauge theory for gravity. So far, we have only achieved a naive quantization in the sense that we cannot preserve all classical symmetries of the physical Hamiltonian on the quantum level. But we are working on it, and maybe an improvement of the quantization might cure some of these possible anomalies which occur when you consider the discrete version of these symmetries. So let me finally conclude. On the one hand, we have this unreduced framework in terms of algebra, quantum gravity, where we have a graph non-changing master constraint. And it would be interesting to think about physical reasonable approximations in order to analyze these quantum Einstein equations more in detail. And since it's very close formulated to lattice gauge theory, it might be also easier to handle this framework numerically and get an intuition for these quantum Einstein equations. Of course, there could occur anomalies in the sense that we are not sure whether zero will be contained in the spectrum of the master constraint operator. And also here, if anomalies occur, we would need to improve the quantization of this operator. A different aspect is that we have a kind of operator for quantum diffeomorphisms in this master constraint framework, which is not possible in loop quantum gravity. So it would be interesting to analyze this operator more in detail and understand what is meant by a quantum diffeomorphism. And on the other hand, we have this reduced framework. So future work would be to do cosmological perturbation theory up to second order. It's straightforward in this framework. You do not have to worry about the gauge invariants of your perturbations anymore because you just perturb gauge invariant quantities. And of course, the quantization within loop or algebraic quantum gravity would be interesting. It's a second interesting thing would be to compare to the results you obtain in loop quantum cosmology, where you symmetry reduce on the classical side and then quantize and see what differences occurs. And also here, one can use that it's basically formulated like a Hamiltonian lattice gauge theory and use techniques from there. And since we have a Hamiltonian in this framework, we could, in principle, develop scattering theory via Fermi's golden rule. And of course, what one has to understand is how this complicated square root Hamiltonian, in some sense, merges into the standard model Hamiltonian we know or we have on Minkowski space. And yeah, a side remark is here we work with a time-independent Hamiltonian, so it might be interesting to look at the vacuum problem, so basically at the ground state of this Hamiltonian, whether we also have uniqueness problems in this framework, which you usually have in curved quantum field theory. So an idea or how one could think of introducing dust as a clock for general relativity is maybe as the gravitational Higgs, which is necessary to give space and time a meaning. And the idea to work in the reduced and unreduced case and make contact to cosmology is to extract some physics out of loop quantum gravity or algebraic quantum gravity, either in the reduced way or in the unreduced way, in order to make contact to nature. Thank you.
You guys have done an enormous amount of work on this program. When things like this were previously considered by Carol Kupash and other people, they got stuck on the square root, albeit in a much more formal, less well-developed context. But is the square root in the Hamiltonian still a sticking point?
So you have to take care about the sign under the square root, that it's positive.
Well, you have to define the square root.
Yeah, this you would do. You
of
would,
the operator.
Yeah, you would define the operator under the square root and then use the spectral theory in order to get the eigenvalues of the square root.
And are you going to be able to have enough control over the spectral theory to really do that?
Yeah, it's somehow related to the symmetries because these Hamiltonian densities commute classically. And if you are able to quantize this in a way such that the commutator of these Hamiltonian densities commutes, then you can perform the spectral analysis for each sigma separately, and you can project to the positive part of the spectrum for each sigma separately. But if, I think that's the point Lukas and Brown pointed out, that they didn't know whether it's possible to quantize it in a commuting way, and that's we also don't know yet.
Thank you.
Yes?
You said you have phantom dust be your physical clock, and this phantom dust does not obey energy conditions. The thing which usually happens at this stage in the literature, at least traditionally, because I'm in Kupash in the view of the problem of time, is that they simply reject models of matter type that are unphysical.
So it's because of instability issues here. we would expect in general relativity. I mean, you could relax the phantom issue in the sense if you allow your observer to move backwards on the geodesic. If you find with this and introduce a negative lattice function, then I can just use observable dust.
This is just t goes to minus t.
Yes.
That's not very. I'm willing to work with minus t to correct it later.
Yeah, I mean, having given some talks about this, people always say it's rather nice to have negative lips and positive energy. But when we developed this, we thought that especially cosmologists would really not accept a negative lattice function. So we wanted to have the same gauge fixing which you use in standard cosmology, and there the lattice is always to be assumed to be positive.
But I'm puzzled. I mean, if you don't satisfy energy conditions, classically you have instabilities. And I don't think the issue of whether you have instabilities or not is a coordinate issue. I don't think it's a question of whether you label t with minus t.
Yes, but I mean,
instabilities or don't have instabilities.
So I do not violate the energy condition for the total energy momentum tensor of the system. I do it for a separate contribution for the dust, which I would anyway choose very small because it should adopt the role of a test observer. So I would always assume that the scalar field matter contribution which enters positively is much bigger than the one coming from the dust.
But I think Lee's point is that suppose, let us go back to standard cosmology. If suppose I introduce a matter which violates energy condition, and irrespective of how I choose my labs,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to not violate energy conditions. So that is what we want to understand.
Yes.
Yes. Okay, but here the idea was, okay, I could always relate such a framework to a certain gauge fixing. But here the motivation was somehow, okay, I would like to choose a physical gauge. I would like to choose a gauge fixing which is related to a certain Lagrangian I can write up. And if I require that I want the gauge fixing with a certain lattice, then I can use this last Lagrangian, but I have to assume that the energy density is negative.
Maybe we should discuss it because that.
Yeah.
I'm confused on several points, but one, maybe the most important one, is the physical status of this dust. So you compared it to the Higgs particle. So the Higgs that has to do with the electroweak symmetry breaking is an important part of the standard models. If it's not found in someone, you'll have to change.
Okay.
So are you predicting that we have to find some sort of Higgs or gravitational Higgs, and if we don't, we have to change general relativity?
No, it's just what I mean is, if I would like to observe a certain gravity and matter components, I have to introduce clocks additionally, and that's what I meant. I'm not saying it's the dust necessarily, but whenever I would like to observe, let's say, gravity of a standard model, I could also use standard model matter in the relational formalism, but even if I would introduce like the inflaton, for instance, which is supposed to be around, I have a scalar field with a potential, and then all these nice rewritten ways of the constraints is not possible anymore. So I choose the dust in the sense that is the most easy way to introduce a clock and reduce general relativity down to a gauge invariant framework.
So should we think of this as just an illustration of how one might proceed in this way, that you don't really mean that there's another field around?
I mean,
you
if
should
I
be able to take any physical field,
in general,
some appropriate physical field, and play the same game.
Yeah, in general, I mean, if I would measure, then I would measure with respect to a free-falling observer, like I do in cosmology, because that's exactly what the dust does, yeah? And, of course, I agree it would be better to use standard model matter which we have observed, but I don't know the way how to do all this if I use photon devices.
But you are at least taking the point of view that if there was nothing but gravity, you'd have a meaningless theory. Something like a theory of propagation of gravitational waves in otherwise empty space would not have meaning.
So the command is you cannot give space and time a physical meaning if you do not have any matter around. Next to gravity,
that's what I want to say.
Simon?
Yes, a question on the first part. You said you have these kinematical coherent states, mm-hmm. over which the action of the massive constraint is well defined. Have you tried to implement the condition that the expectation value of the mass constraint is zero to try to guess what physical coherent states look like? Or that's...
So these kinematical, because they reproduce the master constraint up to time quantum corrections, so there would be a kind of approximate solution to the master constraint.
Oh, the expectation value is zero.
It's, yeah, on the constraint surface.
Oh, I see.
Because it reproduces. But they are not, I mean, it's an approximate solution, I would say, because you have these quantum corrections.
Okay, so we thank Christina.